2025 Oscars, you were in the house band.
It's not about the gear. It's about knowing how to get a good sound.
When you sit down with a session for Frozen and you're like, okay, I need the sparkling clean sound for arpeggios. When you got the call to sub for Alanis Morissette, you said, I could do one date. I think the guitar player said, you're crazy. If you graduate college and you move to LA now, where is the opportunity?
This episode is sponsored by Gator Cases. Guitarists, like any other musician, value the advantages of proper protection for their gear. Guitars, amps, effects, and accessories all need safe transport and storage. Luckily, Gator's got you covered.
Andrew Sinewick, guitar ace, thank you so much for taking the time to come onto the show.
My pleasure, Zach. It's an honor.
We have a mutual friend in Justin over at Sunset Boulevard, and you subbed for him for a night, didn't you?
Oh, that's hilarious. I was literally texting him this morning like, hey, you should do this podcast. I'll mention you.
I saw when you subbed for that show. I've subbed for Broadway shows. It is so stressful. I want to know if you felt that stress or what it was like for you to go into that show.
I did. I mean, I think if you didn't feel any stress, especially coming from the West Coast, subbing on a Broadway show, you're just not respecting the situation. So, yeah, I did feel a lot of stress, but it went great, I think, and it was really a blast. So thank you, Justin Rothberg, for the opportunity.
How did you prep for it? So I'm assuming he sent you the book. I feel like that situation is probably so different than what you typically do, which is show up, you have no idea what's going on, and you play with an orchestra, but that's so specific. So how did you prep for it versus another type of session that you usually might do?
Yeah, I mean, and kind of like you said, it's the complete opposite. So he got me the book. I printed it out in like extra large like paper because I wanted to make it as close as like a one-to-one recreation of what I would do, you know? So I printed it out in like 11 by 17 paper. And I just, you know, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. So I just kind of went through. And I'm a big Post-it notes guy. I put Post-it notes on everything that was like, definitely come back and look at this. And then that became my like new morning kind of routine was like all the Post-it notes. Charts.
How long did it take for you to prep for it?
It's hard to say. I think I maybe about like a month of, you know, whenever I could, but pretty much every day, a little bit at a time, a little bit every day. And I even, he sent me various recordings, like here's this night with this conductor, and then here's a different night with another conductor. Here's my mix. Here's a different mix. Here's the house mix. And this is nuts, but I made a Pro Tools session and I lined them all up. And then, because the thing is, you know, it's like, especially a show like that, it's nearly 3 hours long. And obviously you're not playing the whole time. And some of it is easy. And then some of it is really difficult. So the thing to do is practice the more difficult stuff, you know, a lot more than all the other stuff. But it's difficult to find, you know, potentially. So I made this Pro Tools session with all these different versions and lined them up and had markers like, I forget now, but like, you know, basically the stuff that you really want to hit is all on a marker and I could play with different versions, different mixes and stuff like that.
That is so smart, right? That's how you should do this kind of thing.
Well, because like you said, I mean, it's not what I'm so used to doing is like, hey, here's this thing you've never seen, and let's just get 8 bars of it, and we'll play 8 bars, and then 20 people will weigh in on what we think about that 8 bars, and then you'll play it 100 more times, every possible variation, and if you make a mistake, we'll just do it again as many times as we need to until everyone in the room agrees we like this version. But, you know, Broadway's the exact opposite. It's like you're just coming in and just trying to plug into this situation and there's no doing it over again. So I just wanted to make sure I had like, you know, every advantage to sound good, you know, and to not embarrass Justin.
I'm trying to get into your head though, as someone at your level and accomplishment of session guitar kingdom, that show in particular has a lot of waiting around. Okay, play this very exposed guitar, acoustic yep. guitar moment, right?
So oh, it makes no sense. I'm a complete moron.
No. So for someone like you, because I get so stressed out about those moments, and I want to know if that goes away or how you channel those moments. So for someone like you, you go, okay, I'm waiting. I'm about to be so exposed. Does that freak you out and your hands get sweaty, or do you live in that fire and you feel comfortable there? Like, how does that work in your head?
Well, really the reason that I wanted to do it was this philosophy of like, get comfortable being uncomfortable, you know? That's just really been my thing for the last few years. And the more of that kind of stuff you do, the easier it becomes in a way. So, yeah, I mean, being a guitarist, especially doing what I do, it's a lot like being the kicker on a football team. You know, like you sit around, nobody even notices you until it's like time to kick the winning field goal that either wins or loses the, you know, the Super Bowl. So, and that show is actually a good example because, like you said, it's a lot of like, I don't know, is there even guitar? And then, oh, all of a sudden, it's like, that's the other thing. It's like all you get is a downbeat. And you're just supposed to play along with the singer. You know, I'm so used to like, okay, we'll give you 8 clicks. You know, oh, do you have enough reverb? Are you hearing everything okay? I got my little personal monitor mixer right here. And again, it's just wanting to force myself to not get too comfortable doing that, but to be able to just excel in any situation, you know.
When you played in the 2025 Oscars, you were in the house band. And you made a post about this, and I could be wrong, but I was looking at the photos of it on Instagram, and it looked like you had this huge rack of gear, like 2 pedal boards, all this stuff at your feet, and the guitarist next to you basically had like a Helix, it looked like. Was that the case?
No, that was Tarek. He did have a Helix, but he also had, I think it was using a divided by 13, like into a cabinet, and I think the Helix was his... That's kind of like his brain that goes everywhere, maybe. And then I think he adds other, you know, supplements. So he also had 2 pedal boards and a head. And
why do you feel though? And okay, so you're both onto this clearly, but why do you feel like that is the best approach in 2025 to show up with the rack and the gear? I'm sure it is, but could you get by with a Helix or a single pedal board, or is it still the best approach to show up with the racks and to do that? Like, that's what we all dream of. We all want to show up to stuff like that.
I sort of live in whatever world is existing for me that day, you know?
So you show up to that gig with... What did you show up to play with at the Oscars?
Well, we have to take a step back in that the Oscars isn't just one day. It's I think it's 8 days. So you do all this pre-recording at Warner Brothers with the same orchestra plus rhythm section. And so all, you know, basically what happens is you treat that as a recording session. So all your stuff gets delivered and you do the best that you can for each cue. And in my view, it was like, well, I've already been using this for a week. Let's just use all the same stuff on the actual show. Right? So, I mean, you're always trying to do the absolute best you can. And, you know, when you have the means, it's like, why not? Well, on a show like that, the point is to do it at the absolute, you know, top of the top.
Right. So you show up with all that gear, and then what do you think you get with those racks that, like, I'm not getting with my pedal board? But I mean that seriously. Like, with all that extra gear, is it just more access to different effects and more pedals on your board?
Or yeah, I mean, honestly, here's the thing. Nothing, really, because your concept of how you want to sound is the most important thing. And it doesn't matter, like, whether you're playing out of a crate, which I actually have a crate and it's awesome, or a dumbbell. You're probably going to, like, your ears are going to go for the same thing, basically. You know what I mean? I'm pretty much going to sound the same out of either of those amps. So it just becomes a question of comfort. And By the way, I have a bunch of like multi-effects things too, and I love all that stuff, but it's a lot of times it's faster and just less to think about if you're like, okay, this thing's handling my, I don't know, time-based effects, and then these pedals are handling my drives, you know what I mean? And then, okay, cool, I can store that as a sound. It's just a comfort level and a speed, you know, efficiency thing.
When you showed up in L.A., so you graduated from the University of Miami, you showed up in L.A., and I think I've heard you say that you were like, I'm going to do the Mike Landau thing. I'm going to hand everyone two XLRs. They're going to plug it in. I've got my preamps. I've got everything ready to rock. And nobody was into this, right?
Right.
People were so confused by this.
Yeah.
So what is that story where you showed up thinking it's going to be one thing, and then they said, well, we've got some 57s here. Can we just mic some cabs? Like, what do we do? Nobody knew how to handle that.
I mean, that's pretty much the story. What you're leaving out is I'm the new guy, and in a town like LA, you know, there's so much history, and the list is so deep of incredible players that when somebody new shows up, there is this kind of like, you know, who is this kid? Like, there's no way he's any good, and where's my friend that should be here instead, you know? So on top of all that, for to say like, dude, here's my sound, here's my two XLRs. It's like, people, it was just, I tried it like once or twice, and then eventually I just realized, I mean, all of this, it depends on what each session is different. It depends on so many factors. But in general, I just realized, you know, the thing to do to be successful here is to just, you know, just kind of not totally rock the boat in a way. Not be difficult. You just want to be easy to work with, you know? So it's like, if you want it to be, hey, nice to meet you. Oh, great, you're already plugged in kind of thing. Not like, it's like, there was an old commercial where it was like, you never get a second chance to make a first impression, you know? Like, if the first impression is like, dude, I'm going to do this crazy weird thing. Here's my two XLRs. Like, it's not going to help you, you know?
What did you think when you first moved to LA? What in your head did you think the opportunity was? Did you carve out like, okay, if I can do this many things each week, that'll pay this, that'll make enough money to support me, and I'll figure out how to go to from there? Like, showing up as a new session musician, what did you think you were going to be doing?
Well, that's a good question. I think if I had it, like, if I had a magic wand, I thought I would be to use like a ridiculous analogy that would hopefully like get the message across. I you know, like, David Foster has a song that he's producing for some new artist, and he picks up the bat phone and he calls the A-team, you know, and it's like that kind of thing. So I thought I kind of like really wanted to be doing that, you know, kind of almost like the Dan Huff kind of thing. But as I was coming up, the music business was changing so drastically, you know. So luckily, I mean, dude, I still get to do that kind of stuff, and it's the most incredible thing in the world. But I love playing guitar every day. So, you know, again, whether it means like subbing on Broadway or playing on a singer-songwriter's album and just sending the tracks, or playing with an orchestra live in a scoring stage, I want to be able to do all of that and excel at all of that. And that's kind of, you know, that's the 2025 version of being a session guitarist in LA, you know?
Were you confident, though, when you were moving to LA, I think around 2004, were you confident that there was going to be enough work for you? Or did you think, I don't even know if there's enough work, but what other option do I have? I have to try to figure out how to make this work.
I thought there would be enough. I wasn't confident. I wasn't sure, I guess, about my abilities. But I knew I didn't want to stay in Miami. I knew I didn't want to move back home. And I knew that for my skill set, based on my research, I should say, LA seemed like the best bet at that point in my life, when I was still young enough where, like, I could come out here and just and fail and figure it out after that, if you know, that's what happened.
But you thought, like, even – but did the industry seem like it was dried up, and were you worried about that? Or you thought, I'm going to find work.
That
I'm going to figure out how to do it.
I don't think I was even aware enough to know what the industry, quote unquote, meant. You know what I mean? Like, I had played on some sessions in Miami, like big records. But I was just still at that like starving college student stage where I was just yes to everything, you know?
Andrew, how did you get so good? Because I feel like everybody practices a lot, but you are so versatile and you play everything so well. Was it just the fact that do you think you have this ability to focus on things and keep practicing and practicing and practicing more than maybe other people? And there's other amazing guitar players too, but you are so versatile and so competent in so many areas. How did you develop that?
Do you want to be my manager?
Yes. No, I can't do that. I'm serious, though. It's so mind-blowing. How did you do that?
I have no life.
Is that the answer, though? But, like, that's what – but, like, in a way, I mean, like, is it the fact that you just were able to be so focused on it? Like, are other people not as focused? Even other great players. Like, what is it?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, it's not – there's no secret, man. Like, to do anything well, like, you just have to put the time in. It really, it's like whether you want to be like an elite athlete or an author, I don't know, or a painter, it's all the same thing. It's like, I have this book, The War of Art. Have you read that?
You know, it's been on my list forever. I haven't gotten around to it. I've been meaning to read it for a long time.
It's basically like, if you have something you want to do, the rest of the world is like fighting for your time, and you have to shut that out and just focus on the thing that you want to do and keep moving the ball forward a little bit more every day.
So you would basically be in college at the University of Miami, and I just picture you just locked yourself away and you go, I have to get good at this instrument, and you keep practicing. And how did you know, like, sometimes when I pick up to practice a guitar, I'll spend a lot of time with it, but sometimes I don't quite know what I should be practicing in that moment. How did you know, or how do you know the important things to practice or what you should be focusing on?
That's a good question. I also did a lot of like reaching out to working players, and I would take what they said to heart and like really do that thing. I've mentioned him before. Dan Warner was this incredible guitar player. He kind of just ruled the scene in Miami. And he was just the greatest guy, too. And I hit him up like, hey, I want to do what you do. And he just told me, he gave me a few pieces of advice, and I just really took it to heart, you know? Like, one was like, hey, you are what you eat. If you only listen to jazz, you're not going to know what to do if somebody brings you, like, a three-chord country song or whatever, you know? And also, like, if you want to be a studio guitar player, it's not about the gear. It's about knowing how to get a good sound on quote-unquote tape. So go out and buy a Pro Tools rig and figure that out. That's a skill into, you know, like you were asking me previously about the Helix versus whatever. None of that stuff matters. It's all about you show up, you use XYZ into whatever the recording medium is, and out comes a sound. None of the specifics matter other than can you get a sound that the person who's saying yes or no likes. You know what I mean? That's really the skill.
So you're like in your, I'm picturing this, that you're in your dorm room, I guess, with a Pro Tools rig. And what are you doing? Like, how do you figure out how to get good at this? Are you doing mic placements and then are you figuring out what?
Yeah. And I mean, Pro Tools rig sounds really sophisticated. This, you have to remember, it was already, that would have been around, like, let's say 2003. I bought my first computer in 2003, and it was a Dell, okay? And I had the 002R because that's like the bare minimum cheapest way to get into Pro Tools at that time. I had that and an SM57. And you go, you sit in the room and you go, cool, my amp sounds really good. Let me put the mic on the cabinet. And then you play back and you're like, huh, it sounds terrible. Well, and then now there's like a million possibilities for why it sounds terrible. And you just, again, it's just like trying to get closer to what you hear in your head and figure it out scientifically. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I did.
How do you have
it's like that patience? You can practice that stuff just like you can practice whatever, Mixolydian, you know?
I love the story, though, that somebody showed you an Avril Lavigne album, I think, when you were in
college.
That
was Dan, yeah.
That was Dan. And he says, you got to learn this. And you go, why would I learn this? Yeah. And then you listen and you go, oh, I have to learn this. So then you go home and do you start shedding that album?
Well, no, I mean, I wouldn't say like shedding that album, but more just like conceptually. Again, it's the same thing as like dissecting a Charlie Parker solo and going, what is he doing over this chord? You're just going, what is Corky James doing over the second verse? It's the same thing, other than the particulars are different. But like that kind of scientific, like, what's happening? Do I understand it? And then can I recreate that through my own whatever prism, you know?
And then how'd you become so good at reading? Just by reading a lot, as I'm sure the answer. But how would you know what to read or where would you find material to read?
I had a lot of help from Randall Dallahan. He was the teacher at Miami while I was there. And there was actually a class called Sight Reading for Guitar. And he had, the guy was like a machine. He had it so dialed, like from like square one to square 100, you know, how to sight read. And it was basically like five guitarists in a room sucking really bad. And each day you suck a little bit less. And then when I moved here, there were all these, I've mentioned this before, but like there were all these like rehearsal bands at the Union, like big bands, kind of like these semi-retired people that just have all these charts. And you get plugged into that scene and then people will go, hey, I hear you can read. And then eventually it becomes, hey, I'm a composer, I hear you can read. So now it's like, oh man, I really have to go back to the drawing board again and keep upping my skill set in terms of reading, you know?
Can you explain to me, like, I'm always curious about how far someone can go being a sight reader on guitar, because I think it's probably one of the hardest instruments to sight read on versus piano or something else. Like, is there a chance, do you think you could have sight read Sunset Boulevard, or would that have been too all over the place to follow the conductor and sight read and do the instrument changes and the choreography? Or like, do you think in a jam, could, like, is that possible to sight read? Like, how far can you get to, how far can you develop your level of sight reading on guitar?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could. I mean, I think Justin even said, like, you know, if you had to, you could probably read it, but you wouldn't want to. And like you said, it's not even so much the notes, it's all the other, like, wait, am I watching the conductor or listening to the vocalist? And, like, what am I, you know, it's like all that other stuff, kind of, you know, it's not just the notes on the page.
That makes sense. What do you talk to Tim Pierce about? I love this idea that you and Tim Pierce, like, hang out and he gives you advice and maybe vice versa and you just trade stories or whatever. Like, what do you guys talk about when you hang out?
If I told you, I'd have to kill you.
No, tell me something good. Come on.
Anything and everything. Yeah.
But did he give you any advice? Like, there's a video where he gave you great advice about how to handle being double booked, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did he give you advice there where he said, call both people and see who seems more disappointed that you might have to move a session?
It wasn't that exactly, but yeah, all that kind of stuff. Anything. Literally anything.
That's it. That's what you talk to Tim about.
Yes.
And he's the best. He's the best.
He is. He's right. He's on my Mount Rushmore of guitar players for sure.
Okay. When you got called to play the Let It Go session, you were double booked on that day.
Yes.
So you called. What do you do? So you call the person that you were double booked with, and you said, "Can this move? Or like, what do I?"
Yeah. Like, hey, I know it's just you coming over. Are you under a deadline, or could we do this the next day, or something like that? You know.
So she says, okay, we can move the session.
Yeah, she says, she not only that, she goes, oh no, you have to do that. That's going to be big. I had no idea.
You didn't know, because was that kind of work new at the time for you, or you just didn't know what the session was?
It was slightly new for me at the time, and you just never, like, because you got to remember, like, you're doing the recording, like, still, even though it's the last thing to happen usually, it's still, like, 6 months before anything comes out in theaters. 6 months before you see it plastered on every billboard and, you know, coming out of every TV or whatever.
So you go,
So it's just, this is the crazy, you know, the mental part of being a freelancer is you're just like, I don't know, should I do this or that? It's all the same. It's all just an email, you know, usually. Now, once you've been here a while, you could sort of, I don't know, kind of guess, but even that you get wrong probably at the time. So, yeah.
So you go into that session, and then the guitar part on Let It Go, I think, compared to maybe other like big orchestral performances, like you can actually really hear the guitar part when you listen to it. Like it's really audible. So was it...
Wow, well, you have better ears than I do, because I'm always like, I wish it were louder.
No, I think half the time you listen to things, you can't hear there's guitar, even though there is.
Yeah.
Maybe it could be louder, but you can hear the arpeggios, and like you can,
right.
Like the guitar is on the track, for sure.
For sure.
So when you sit down in the session for Let It Go, was every note basically completely orchestrated? And, you know, was there any interpretation, or was it all just written out? Right
no,
there on the session.
I think really the only thing that's written out is that kind of pretty interesting thing that happens in the bridge, because there's actually like a rub. There's like these two little lines happening where there's like a pretty clear rub in the orchestra.
Like intentionally, or is there like...
Yeah, well, I guess. I mean, you got to assume it's intentional. But everything else was kind of just like chord changes, I think. I'm trying to remember. I mean, it's a long time ago.
Wait, that's what was on the session? It was just chord changes? And did they tell you when to come in, like in the second verse, or when you come in playing those arpeggios? Did you figure out when to do that, or does someone tell you?
I think it probably said something like, sneak in here, you know? And certainly at the time, if I were to approach that, I'd be trying to add guitar everywhere, where they'd be like, stop playing, you know? But at the time, I was definitely trying, like, not to rock the boat, so... I'm sure I was just like, okay, I'll sneak in, you know.
And then the chords are there, and you go, okay, what does sneaking in mean? You go, I'm just going to arpeggiate these, like, very gently. That's what it felt like.
Yeah, just trying to find your space. I mean, again, it's like there's already an 80-piece orchestra. There's probably not a lot of room, so you just have to pick and choose your spots. And then there's that thing where it's like, because you're trying to anticipate... Is this going to be the take, or are we going to do 20 more takes? So I always find that the first take is often like really great, and then I'll just try and find all this stuff, and none of it's as good. But they'll pick the one where I was like, well, that one was all over the place for me. And then you're doing this mental gymnastics of like, should I run in and ask them to grab, you know, and then sit behind the Pro Tools operator going, wait, grab bars 82 to 84 from take two. And then at the end of the day, you just have to go, I did my best, and, you know, throw it out there and hope for the best.
Isn't that like sometimes like I'll bring something up where I'll be like, oh, we should use this other take instead of that take. And then they go, why? Is there something wrong with this take? Like, what's wrong with it? And then I go,
no,
it's fine. If you like it, like sometimes you bring these things up and then people get insecure about the take or the session or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's like, isn't it better just shut up and just be like, what, use what you want. If it sounds good to you, it sounds good to me. Like, is that the mentality?
99, absolutely. I would say 99% of the time it's better to just shut up.
And just take and just go with it. Just take what they're giving, and if they're happy, you're happy, right? Like,
well, here's the thing. I'm sure we've all experienced this phenomenon of like, I'll use like an example of playing my own gig, where you play a gig and you think, well, that was terrible. And then you hear it back a week later and you're like, oh, there's some pretty great stuff there, you know, or vice versa. So the point being, like, unless it's your name on the record, it's really not up to you. So if they're happy, great.
That's it. How are you? Do you remember, like, when you sit down with a session for Frozen and you're like, okay, I need these sparkling clean, the sparkling clean sound for arpeggios. And then it feels like there are some, maybe some power chord moments in there. How are you getting that tone knowing it's going to sit in with a whole orchestra? Like, is your process different the way you think about it? Or do you go, it doesn't really matter, just any clean tone is going to work as long as it sounds really good?
Yeah, I think in that context, there's probably not going to be as much room to do like the stereo spread, everything's bouncing and all the pixie dust and all that kind of stuff. And also, I think they were just going for almost like guy in a band versus like super produced guitars. And in addition, you know, the way that that went down, I was out a football field away from the control room with the orchestra. So there's not really like, versus if we did that just as a rhythm section or just me and the producer, it'd be a lot easier to like really dial in each section. But they were really going for more of a performance, you know.
It's a great record. Do you feel a connection to it? Like when you hear it, do you go, oh my God, I played on that? Or like, or do you feel kind of removed from a lot of this stuff and you go, I showed up, I played, I was on to the next thing?
I feel, I understand that that song is important for other people in a way that other songs are important for me. And I have tremendous appreciation for what that is.
Did you noticeably get more calls after that song became what it was? Like, do people start calling you because they want the Let It Go thing?
I don't think so. And for better, for worse, I don't even know what is the Let It Go thing. Like, in a way, I feel like kind of grateful that you can't go, oh, it's that, because that way I can't get pigeonholed, you know, into like, oh, he's the guy that does X, Y, Z.
Okay, that makes sense. Andrew, when you...
I think that's a much better place to be, you know, in a way. Like, in some ways, I've kind of lamented the fact that, like you said, like, I guess in some ways, I just think it's better to not be so quantified, if that makes any sense.
Yes. Yeah. When you pick up, like, a weird double instrument, like bouzouki or some West African instrument that now you have to play or whatever, like, this is how I'm trying to understand how you learn these instruments. Like, will you look up chord charts or will you just start fumbling around on them and figuring out what each note is, and then in your head you're mapping this where everything is? Like, how do you learn an instrument that's not guitar?
Well, every case is different, but kind of the latter. Like, you sort of... Well, the first thing is, like, what is it that this person wants me to do on this track? And usually there's a reference, like, hey, listen to this thing. Can we get some of this on my track? So that's the first thing. And then you go, well, what is that, you know? And inevitably, it's like the thing that they play you is, like, lays really well because it's in the open key of that instrument, but their thing is like in this other weird key and modulates 12 other times. Like, so that becomes the challenge, really, you know,
of figuring out how to play a different instrument.
Yeah. And again, like, every scenario is kind of different, but there is that skill of it's almost like that is a skill in and of itself that gets a little bit easier, like picking up some new thing and just playing it. I mean, it's not really that different than if you were at some other producer's house and they were like, hey, Zach, you know, would you mind? I really have this old 335 that I like. And you pick it up and at first it's like, oh, it's kind of weird. It's not the strings that I would use, or the action is different or whatever. But then eventually you're like, oh, it does this really well. Okay, cool.
That's it.
Getting comfortable, being uncomfortable thing, you know, it's all this stuff for me is that really.
Is that like when you got the call to sub for Alanis Morissette, the guy, you couldn't make some of the dates, but you said, I could do one date. And I think the guitar player said, "You're crazy if you want to learn all this material for one date, but actually that could help us out." Like, why do you do that? Because it's just, it's that get makes you uncomfortable. Like, that's where you want to be, is in that zone.
I guess so. Yeah. It's kind of a recurring theme. The "you're crazy if you want to do this."
Isn't that your superpower though? Like, I feel like part of the reason I don't go after sessions as much as maybe I could is because I don't want to be like the most novice guy in the room, or I don't want to be unprepared, or I'm worried they're going to need a skill set that I don't have. Like, did you have any of those thoughts, or did you feel like you were really prepared to go in and do it?
No, every day I have that thought. I mean, but that's, again, that's kind of where I live. Like, it sounds cheesy, but I want that beginner's mindset. I always want to be excited to learn something, you know? That's really where I feel like I'm firing, like, on all cylinders.
Is in that moment, I don't know how you get past it, though. Like, how do you get past it to a place where you can perform? Because I feel like sometimes it's, like, debilitating. Like, sometimes I'll be like, I don't know if I can do that gig because I don't know if I know how to play Spanish classical gypsy jazz or whatever. I'm making this up. Like, but you're just like, I'm just going to figure it out.
Well, the only way to know is to try it, really.
Yeah.
And then you make yourself uncomfortable. You try it. It goes, I mean, look, this is all this stuff is pass fail. You're not getting a grade. It's either he did okay, try him again, call him again, or don't ever call that guy again. And as long as it's not don't ever call that guy again, then you pass. So, like, just keep going. Like, okay, great. Knock that one down. What's the next thing?
Did you have sessions early on that you think you played on and they went, don't call that guy again?
Yeah, for sure. There's one in particular right in the beginning that I just... It was all temped up with, like, Brian Setzer stuff. And it was... And really, the way to do that is to just... And it was all these, like, kind of like Christmas songs that you know because you've heard them a million times, but, like, arranged for big band with Brian Setzer playing the melody. And to me, if I were, like, giving that to somebody else, I'd be like, here's Let It Snow. Make it sound like Brian Setzer. You know how it goes. Okay, but what they did was... note for note, piano player played into the computer Insanity with every trill, every slide, every chromaticism. And if I saw that now, I'd be like, okay, I think I know what to do. But at the time, I was like, oh my gosh, the page is black, I don't know what. And I'm trying to, like, make everything, which is not really what you should do. But it was rough. I mean, we got through it, but it was not an easy day, let's say. And I do think that was like a... Well, I know that I've never worked for that composer ever again. And we know a lot of the same people, so...
Even now, he wouldn't give you another shot.
Seems like it.
What is the opportunity now? Like, if you graduate college and you move to LA now, like, where is the opportunity now... where it's like you're probably not going to get the big calls out of the gate. So it's like, what is the opportunity? Is it demo sessions? Is it just local gigs, local songwriters? Like, where is the opportunity to make it playing guitar, to just, I don't know, even make a little bit of a living in LA?
Yeah, I'm not sure, but I think, like most things these days, I think it's just wearing a ton of hats, you know? Yeah, just being able to say yes to everything. And really, that's no different than it was when I moved here. It's the same thing. Like, hey, I heard you'd be good for this. And you go, oh, I'm not sure. I mean, it's like, I'm not sure, but let's try it, you know?
That's it. Okay, we're wrapping up here with Andrew Sinewick. You posted on Instagram this video of you playing with Alanis Morissette, and you called out your favorite Steve Morris triplets lick. Can you demonstrate this lick? What is the triplets lick? No? What do you mean no? Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you know what I'm referencing?
I guess. I mean, it's funny. She has that song where there's like this insane like trading back and forth. I mean, yeah, I don't... I think it'd have to be kind of like in the moment, you know? Like, I don't really play that way all the time.
But what was the, so in your head, you're thinking of like a Steve Morris lick when you're doing that, when you're on that record, well, when you're on stage, and then like why did you go, here's my favorite Steve Morris lick? Or was that like a little facetious?
It's kind of more facetious. There's like an inside joke I have with my buddy that like Steve, every Steve Morris thing is like,
that's the Steve Morris ism.
Yeah.
That's A-lick.
Of course. That's A, yeah, sure.
That's the vocabulary, though. That's what it is.
It's a lot more than that. His writing is so deep, you know, and his concept on just how to live in the world and how to be a musician. That's really what I got from Steve Morris, you know.
That's what it is. Okay, what are we working on the rest of the week? Like, where what are we practicing? You wake up every day and you play guitar for like an hour, right? Just on your own.
Ideally, thing. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, I've been getting into this 4-note per string thing. Have you ever worked on that?
4 notes versus 3 notes per string. You're adding four yeah. notes to the string. What
it's
is...
pretty, here, I just happen to have my guitar here.
This
it's,
is...
Where's the sound? There's the sound. It's like, I'm a big fan of like putting parameters on yourself and then practicing within those parameters. So it'd be like, I'm going to play the C major scale, like going up 4 notes per string just across the top 2 strings, right? So like, let me scoot up a little bit here. Be like on the, you know, let's say on the top 2 strings, so your lowest note would be B, the open B string, 2nd string, and you just go like 1, 2, 3, 4, and then to the E string, so, and then, so that was starting on B, then you go up each note through the scale, so then C. You get the idea. But it sounds like, well, that sounds like a kid playing guitar, which is how I normally sound. But what it does is it forces you to do stuff that you wouldn't normally do, you know, and then you go, okay, I'm going to go up the scale or down, and then I'm going to go down and up or up and down through the keys all around the fretboard. And, you know, it actually helps with your reading too, or like if you're on a session and somebody's like, you know, oh, can you play that part but change that note, and you're already in a weird position on the guitar, it kind of, I guess it goes back to that thing of like, I want to be comfortable anywhere on the neck, you know?
So 4 notes per string.
Yeah. I feel like it's coming out of like some shreddy, like Paul Gilbert thing.
This is the new thing everyone's going to be doing.
Okay.
4 notes per string.
I patented it. It's mine. I came up with it.
This is the Andrew Sinewick 4 notes per string method. I'm going to exactly, play around yeah. with this later today, though. I'm gonna check it out.
Let me know what you think. It's really uncomfortable, and you'll be like, I hate this. I suck. I sound terrible. But
yes.
That means you're doing it right.
Do you think I have this theory? I saw you had an M9 on your board. Uh-huh. I have this theory that those things are going to skyrocket in value. Because
why?
Every session, they don't make them anymore. You can get them on Reverb for a couple $100, and every session player uses them. Visually, you see them everywhere. Like, I think that those are like going to become very desirable. This is a crazy theory.
I like your theory. I mean, they're great. The HX effects is also great.
Do you have a preference, though?
Well, you can do a lot more with the HX effects, but it's bigger. So,
yeah.
But again, I would think about them the same way. Like, oh, I know what I should do on this because of this record I listened to 20 years ago. I should put this weird sound on the 2nd verse. And it's in this, you know, like, so whether it was the M9 or the HX effects or the Fractal Audio or the, you know, Metal Zone, I would still go for the same thing, not because of the gear, but because of my concept, you know?
Right. What is there any really weird, crazy movie score session record that you played on that like nobody would know that you played on, or something totally out there?
Well, you know what's funny? So when you asked me to be on this podcast, I listened to some other episodes, and so I listened to the Ron Fair one. And he, the very start of the episode, he randomly is talking about this song I did for him, which I can't believe. Out of all the stuff he's done, all the huge records, he's talking about this Jake Owen song I did for him. It's
you did a Jake Owen song for Ron Fair?
Yeah, and it's just guitar and vocals. It's crazy. It's What Child Is This? And he called me like out of the blue. Hey, I have this idea for this song. I don't think it should be a big production. I think that's not the right approach. I really want to be like kind of this intimate guitar vocals. Although the guitars themselves could be kind of like an orchestra, but not in like a over the top way. It just needs to be, you know, kind of or lush but understated. That was kind of what he told me he wanted. And so I came up with this arrangement, and it's, I think I used a baritone acoustic for a lot of it because he sings so low. Jake Owen has this like, such like this manly voice. So it's like, I don't know, I tuned to like low Z or whatever on the baritone and then like overdubbed some 12 string stuff. So you get this full spectrum of sound. And then I remember I did this pass of like crazy, like loopy and like delay trails running all over the place thinking like Ron's going to love this. I'm going to be his new guy now. And he basically threw it all away, but he loved the acoustic stuff and that's all that matters. But if you listen to it, you actually can hear in the very beginning, there's some like echoey, almost sounds like an old like Sputnik tuning in, you know, like this delay stuff. And then there's a little bit that sneaks in throughout the song.
Do you ever hang out with like Nashville session guys, or does it feel like almost even different industries in a way?
I just don't. I know RJ Ronquillo because we went to school together, so I talked to him a fair amount. But I just don't know any of the other guys. I follow what they do though, and obviously I love it. I geek out on that stuff as much as anyone. Yeah.
What's been like the craziest, like is the craziest session the Who? Like you're a massive Who fan. Like does that stand out as like one of the greatest sessions for you? Even though it almost sounds like an underwhelming recording in a way because they weren't even there. But is that like something that was just like the pinnacle?
Yeah, I mean, kind of. Like, to me, that's... Like, I started learning how to play guitar from watching Pete Townsend. So then to go and actually... I mean, I'm not going to use the word replace him, but to accompany Roger Daltrey on a record that says The Who on it and see my name next to Pete Townsend's under guitar... Like, I can't believe I'm saying that sentence right now. You know what I mean? Like, it's crazy. So, yeah. Now, and I will say, it's equally, I don't know, I get as much joy out of some brand new singer-songwriter that's never been in a studio before, but has this concept of what they want on their song. And then between the two of you, there's like this back and forth, and you create this thing, and you just see their face light up. That's actually equally fulfilling to me. So I think it takes both, you know?
I have to imagine that is the greatest feeling ever to have someone in the studio who's maybe a little bit uncomfortable, and you get to be the guy who goes, I am so comfortable in this space, I'm going to help make you comfortable because you're going to get the record you want. Like, that's got to be the greatest feeling as a session musician to know that you have the ability to do that, maybe with like a newer artist or whatever. Like, is that just the greatest moment, like you just said?
Yeah, it really is. And I mean, it's always a moving target. So that's the challenge in that it's never the same approach to get the same result every day. So that's kind of, that's really the challenge of being a studio guitarist.
Okay, I'm wrapping up here. Don't you think Pete Townsend is like the most underrated acoustic guitar player ever? Like, don't you think his acoustic guitar strumming is unbelievable?
Yeah, I mean, is he underrated? I certainly don't underrate him.
I feel
amazing.
Like people don't think about his acoustic guitar playing. That blows my mind. Like, if you listen to, like, Bargain or, like, anything where he's just ripping acoustic guitar, on one side of the headphones. It's always incredible to me, right?
It's incredible. It's so good.
Unbelievable. Andrew Sinewig, what's been unsaid? What have we left out here in our final moments?
I think we've said everything there is to say. I don't know. I'm just trying to play my own music. So if people check that out, I think that'd be awesome.
You put out a great record with Osnoy recently that the two of you guys did.
Thanks. Yeah.
There's a record out, Fun, which I think was your debut record.
No, that was, well, depending on how you look at it, I did an ambient record in, 2016 maybe. That was all me here just trying to be Brian Eno, kind of. And then I did a record called Second Story, which is like kind of, I don't know what you call it, whatever it is I do. It's like, I sort of call it like instrumental Allman Brothers-y kind of stuff. Then I did that record Fun that you mentioned, which is sort of a continuation, and an EP called Games. So Fun and Games. I did those with Jim Scott, the great recording engineer and producer. And then most recently was the record with Osnoy.
Recreational Substances, which was a great record. Yes. I love listening to the two of you guys together. He is such a character, isn't he? He's unbelievable.
Oh, it's hilarious. Yeah, he's so good.
You guys did this. You do this the best way. You basically are like, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go play a couple gigs, and then we're going to record. That's it. We're not going to like overthink it. We need to play this music live. That's how you make these records, typically.
100%. Yep.
That's how you do it. These are great records. People have to go listen to them. Recreational Substances, too. When I was interviewing Oz, I was listening to that record, and it's so good. The playing on it is monstrous. It is unbelievable.
Thank you. It was a really fun one to make, especially having Marvin Smitty Smith on drums. He's like a hero of mine, you know. And then Hadrian Farad on bass is such a shredder. He's crazy.
Unbelievable. Andrew Sinewick, I am inspired by your playing, by your career. You are the benchmark of what we're all trying to reach for. Seriously, the diversity, the effortlessness. Is that the right word? You just play with such ease, and you just seem so comfortable in any situation. And it is inspiring. I am inspired by it. So I appreciate you taking the time to talk about it.
Thank you, Zach. It's been my pleasure.
Absolutely. Play us out. Play us out with something.
Play you out.
If you're willing.
Can I make a loop? Can I do?
Yeah.
Weird?
Let's loop. Let's loop something.
Let's see. Let's see if I can even, if this stuff even works. Here, let's see. You're going to have to edit out all the dead air.
We'll edit out the dead air. That's fine. We can do that.
Let's see. All right. Let's see what happens. I have no idea what's going to happen. Oh, yeah. This is good, baby.
Oh, this is going to be good. I like this. Okay, let's do it again, but this time with a little bit... No, I'm kidding.
More feeling.
More feeling. No, that was beautiful. Andrew Sinewick. Dude, great to meet you, man. Thank you for taking the time. If you're ever in Nashville
Likewise.
And you need anything, let me know.
Will do. Likewise.
See you next time. Peace.
Be well, man.
Woo. Dude, appreciate it, man. Did we get it? We were recording, too. That's a good thing.
I hope it all sounds good.
Oh, yeah, man. I love it. Dude, appreciate it. Talk to you next time.
Thanks, Zach.